This is John Baisley from Baroness, and you're listening to Sound Sessions and Paul Bearer's Vocal Warm-Up.
I think that's good.
All right, cool. We're cool with it.
Welcome back to another episode of Sound Sessions. I am once again backstage here at the Metro in Chicago, and this time I am very pleased to be joined by John Baisley and Sebastian Thompson of Baroness. Hey, guys.
How you doing?
How you doing?
So, guys, you've been putting out music now for over 10 years. The band has been releasing music. I know you said you've been a member for about 3 years now, Sebastian. That's a long time to be putting out music with one band. How do you guys keep it going? How do you keep things fresh?
Yeah, because I'm older than you guys.
Actually, we started in 2003, so it's been 13 years. Yeah. I think we're just the sort of people that like touring and enjoy writing and recording and then going through the process. And it's, I don't know, it's always fun.
Yeah.
If it stopped being fun, we'd stop doing it, you know?
Sure.
The money's not that good. Right. We could get better jobs very easily, but this is just, you know, this is what we do. It's an adventurous lifestyle that suits me.
That's cool.
So throughout the process of your albums coming out, there's a bit of a theme, if people somehow haven't noticed by now. Colors are obviously a big thing, and like I mentioned, you guys are in town in support of Purple, your latest album. Is there anything you can speak to about that theme? And then I also feel like there's a theme in the artwork and in the name itself of kind of like a female figure at times. Anything you guys can talk about with that?
Actually, I want to see if I'm right about something.
Okay.
Because I'm, like I said, I only play on Purple because I've only been in the band for 3 years. And when people have asked me about the color thing, this is what I picked up on. Maybe I'm wrong. Let's see. I was like, I thought that because John does the artwork and because Baroness had the opportunity to do this, I think maybe it was like a challenge to the band or to yourself to say like, hey, we're in control of this, let's see how long we can get this thing to go on for, right?
Yeah.
This thing being the theme? Oh,
yeah. Different colors of different albums. And I think maybe I even said it once, like, you're like, what would our merch table look like if we had, like, you know, six albums of different colors, cool. Obviously one color each, you know? So maybe that's part of it, right? It
was like... That's actually a big part of it, yeah. I mean, the first time we had the discussion about it, we had released a couple of EPs, and our first EP was called First, and our second EP was called Second, and our third EP had a name, but everybody called it Third because we'd already established that. So the idea there was just that maybe for a variety of reasons, it didn't feel like we could sum up the idea of the album, you know, in a phrase or a word or anything like that, and that maybe, you know, doing something simple, very non-committal, would allow our potential audience not to, you know, have any expectations based on the title.
Sure.
So when we've got a record deal with Relapse Records, we said, okay, this is a new era of the band. We should move on, you know, beyond the numeric thing. At the time, I was doing a lot of artwork, and I was working for a lot of bands, and so I thought, well, we could stay with the same sort of theme that really doesn't say much. It's almost another way of, you know, doing a numeric style of thing, you know, and it suited us in particular because the artwork was such a priority of mine.
Sure.
And, you know, I think our drummer at the time, you know, jokingly said, well, if we did, you know, just simple names of primary colors and just went through it, if we stay a band long enough, we're going to have like a rainbow on our merch table, and it's going to, you know, that would be cool.
Yeah.
So it, you know, it was a bit of a challenge. I thought we would have ditched it long ago.
Yeah.
I gotta say, like, from my experience in other bands, like, coming up with album titles is really hard.
Yeah,
it is.
Coming up with song titles is kind of easy, but an album title is like, oh my god, this is like the last year and a half of our lives. I mean, we're working on, like, we really got to think about this, right? You know, so like, the colors is kind of, you know, it's a little bit of a weight off your shoulders, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a huge weight off our shoulders conceptually, because, you know, the themes of the record are, you know, they can be fairly intense or dense or obtuse or whatever. So I think any title that we could possibly come up with that would sum up the album would be super pretentious. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I do think there's some beauty in the simplicity of having a title that really tells you nothing specific about the album. You know, maybe there's like a tonal reference that can be applied, and we certainly go with that, you know, at certain points. But it's, you know, it is at the end of the day, you know, sort of a nod back to like Zeppelin or something.
Okay.
You know,
right.
1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah.
And or Chicago.
Or Chicago.
There you go. So it's not so much, it's just a theme, it's not really a concept thing going on, or are you guys like a concept band, or?
No. Okay. I mean, not in the sense that you can put out a concept album about a story,
right.
You know, because lyrically, I tend to focus on just real experiences. I don't go, you know, the Bruce Springsteen route where, you know, like try to step inside somebody else's shoes.
Sure.
It just doesn't suit my sensibilities.
Sure.
So if we're writing about the time period in which the music is written and the things that have happened, you know, in that time, I just don't want to try to sum that up somehow.
Yeah.
It just seems like too hard a task.
I think there's already so much information in Baroness's music.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many, there's like different layers of guitars.
Absolutely.
and lyrics, and also, so it's cool to maybe like let something be not so have so much information.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
leave it a little bit open.
They're dense recordings.
Sure.
So let's add some levity where we can. You know?
So what about am I maybe reading into things too much? Is there a female theme going on with the band?
Well, this is, you know, sort of from the visual and artistic standpoint, I've got a toolkit that I use. I've got, a visual language that I use.
Yeah.
And I've been making figurative art as long as I've been making images. It's not exactly on trend in the art world. So what I've had to contend with over the years is the fact that this is what I, you know, that's something that I do naturally. I kind of can't help but do that. So in doing so, my process artistically has been trying to figure out why I do that.
Right.
And I can go on all day and all night about how and why I think it's suitable and appropriate, and why, you know, I consider it something more than, you know, illustration or, you know, gross commercialism, you know, something to sell a package or something like that. But it, you know, it more or less boils down to the fact that I'm of the mindset that we have these archetypes loaded into our minds, you know, that everybody around the world understands, you know, a woman is a woman, man is a man, you know, plant life, and, you know, there are certain images that resonate with everybody, and they have different sort of meanings, you know, across time, culture, gender, you know, all those sorts of things. So what I do is I take those things that are really familiar to everyone and try to construct them in a way that, you know, and it takes a lot of research, but I try to construct them and arrange them in a way that suits the music, suits the lyrics, and suits our intent with the album. And it's not straightforward.
Yeah.
You know, it's a story that I understand immediately, but it intentionally isn't supposed to be blunt or blatant to the viewer.
Okay.
You know, so this, you know, like our music, it's open to interpretation.
Sure.
And, you know, to that end, it's also, you know, in an effort to be inclusive, because, you know, the scene of music that we come from, that we've all come from, is one that tends towards exclusivity, you know. And at a certain point in our career, it just, you know, it did feel a little bit like we were preaching to the choir. Like, you know, same crowds over and over again. They got that message years ago.
Right.
And it wasn't necessarily from us, you know. Just like, we didn't come up with that ideal, the DIY ethics or anything like that. That, you know, that was something we learned when we were kids. So what's, you know, so many albums into a career, what's the point in telling your audience the same thing over and over again? when there's when there is a potential audience out there who would benefit from, you know, like a gateway drug or something. You know
sure.
what I mean?
Sure.
Because there's all this underground music that doesn't reach a certain level, and somehow we've sort of gotten we hit that ceiling, and you know we're probably just above it. So, I think that you know with our music we can draw in people who wouldn't typically, you know, go to a metal show
sure.
or something, because I don't think we're typically metal. I think
no,
there's
certainly.
Elements of it. You know, we certainly love it, and there's moments in our music that celebrate that style. But in the same way, everything else can be applied to our music.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way, because when the four of us put it together, it just comes out sounding like us, and that's critical.
Well put. I want to get into the writing process, and I won't beat this theme of the colors to death, but I'm really curious about how you pick a color. So do you have the album color in mind and you're writing to that color, or do you take your collection of songs and say, this feels like blank?
Well, with this record in particular, I really didn't want to do a color thing
okay.
at first.
We talked about it for a while. We're going to stop with the colors.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now that we got, you know, another version of the band,
yeah.
you know, let's like, but we bandied, you know, around some album titles, and we were like,
it didn't sync with everybody. It didn't really feel natural.
Sure.
And Pete and I were in my dining room one day, and we were literally just looking at like a wall of LPs, and you know he's like pointing out where the Baroness LPs were. He's like, look, they like just the spines sort of jump out at you.
Oh, that's cool.
Because yeah. so many people have, you know, just have a black spine or a white spine
right.
with, you know, easy legible text, and you know I and so that was one element of it. Like, well, this works, you know, this is a formula that works, and it's not in a grossly commercial way. It's just, you know, it looks cool on the wall. So that was one element. And then the other thing was, so much had changed in our band with our lineup, with our experience, with, you know, everything that had happened. Again, we had, you know, I think the idea was to kind of fall back on something that felt familiar, that would feel familiar to our crowd,
okay.
you know. And so we had basically two colors left, purple and orange, and I think orange is about as garish a color as it could possibly be. So it's like, you know, like no questions
well,
there.
Well,
you know?
I mean, you know, there's a lot more out there.
It's true.
Yeah, I mean, when
you get your mauves and your teal. And
say, yeah, exactly. But, you know, once it was explained to me like that, I was like, oh, yeah, okay, forget. Let's not overthink this, because we haven't overthought this in the past, and now we are.
Right.
So let's just go back to what feels right, what feels natural. And it did, you know, it did, the idea did suit the music. And if it hadn't, then it wouldn't have been natural, but it did. So we ran with that, and I think, you know, I'm happy because our merch table does look insane now.
Yeah.
I don't want to call it an anniversary, but I guess it kind of is. And I'm not sure, Sebastian, if you were in the band at this point or not. But the bus crash, yeah. Almost 4 years now, was it?
Yeah, 4 years ago on, like, last week.
Okay.
Yeah.
So as an individual and kind of as a band, I know it was before your time, sorry for that, but how did that, like, impact you? And is there any, like, I know it's a really weird question, but is there any positive takeaway from that at all?
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of positive takeaways.
Okay.
But it impacted everything.
Sure.
Like, it would be completely presumptuous of me to say that it didn't impact every aspect of my life. However, in doing so, it did allow me to, you know, appreciate certain things on a deeper level. You know, I don't suggest that as a method for appreciating life a little bit more, but it, you know, it did the trick, and it, you know, it presented some challenges to overcome. And I think that doing that, you know, having something very difficult put in front of you that seems impossible to overcome, and then, you know, pushing through that is a positive.
Yeah.
You know, that in and of itself is maybe one of the greatest positive takeaways you can have from that. And the, you know, the sense of validation I think that we collectively felt, and this includes Seb and Nick, in having, you know, having had to start with, you know, kind of a ramshackle, injured group of individuals, and then becoming cohesive very quickly, and touring very shortly after the accident. You know, when we really there were some sort of compelling reasons not to, you know, having done that, it I think it brought us together, and that in a deeper way, and in, you know, and it happened quickly, and so that propelled us into writing the next record, and that, you know, that's a great thing.
I mean, we started to, what was it, May of the next of the year after the accident? When did we start touring?
No, I think touring we started in May, and then
I mean, and we toured really fast.
We toured, I mean, I was limping on the first tour.
We started jamming in December or January. Or January.
Yeah, yeah, like I wasn't recovered by any means. You know, and in some ways I never will be, but we got functional, we went out on tour, we developed a stage rapport, and then when the year rolled over, we were hungry and ready to write a record, and it just, you know, it was just constant rehearsals, constant writing, and we, I mean, poring over details, which is something, I'm not sure everybody loves that part of the band, but I do. So
I was into it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you,
for me, it was
you
weird.
And I are the ones.
As far as like writing details or like parts, or
it's just like
getting super finicky.
You're finicky about like the strum fill. What should we change it? What should, you know, shit like that. You know, just like
But I mean, at the end of the day, like, or what we would do is, you know, because we're somewhat geographically diverse. We got two guys in New York, one guy in Philadelphia, one guy in southwestern Virginia. So we couldn't, it wasn't like we, you know, Tuesday night everybody come over to the house and practice, you know. We had to do it sort of in segments, and every once in a while we get together and make sure that the, you know, the guts and the soul of the song was there. And then, you know, when we disseminate, then, you know, I could sit there and pour over details and like really embellish things, and we could all consider the, you know, the minutiae of all the songs. But we started off with, I think the idea initially was, let's just come out swinging. Let's be focused. Let's be direct. Let's try to do, you know, in 3 to 4 minutes on this record what we used to do in 6 to 7 minutes, and, you know, some of our long songs, meaning, you know, more brevity with intros and you know, different passages of songs. But let's see if we can keep them in there. Just be a little bit more succinct, I guess.
How did Sebastian? How did you come about to be getting into Baroness here?
Was it John?
It was
John. Yeah.
So one thing that Pete and I really didn't want to do was auditions, like promote the fact that we needed something, like, you know, like we didn't feel desperate, so we didn't want to do something that seemed desperate.
Sure.
Have you seen the Dream Theater drummer audition video?
No, you should watch that. We wanted the exact that's what we didn't want, right?
It's amazing.
So I mean, we at that point we've been a band for a very long time, which means we had a lot of musician friends, and many of whom we trusted implicitly with their, you know, with their ideas.
Sure.
And so it really was a couple phone calls to people who could be trusted with, you know, our needs. And
it's not really a small order either, playing drums in Baroness.
Well, so I called up the most skilled drummer friend that I had and said, you know, you know anybody that's a free, you know, on the market looking for a drumming gig? And he suggested John Theodore, who had been out of Mars Volta, I think, for a little while.
Yeah.
So I got on the phone with John, and John was just, you know, he was, like, really amped on it, but he had just signed on with Queens.
Oh, right.
So he's like, I grew up with this guy, Sebastian. He used to, or not used to, but he plays in his band Trans Am. And I was like, you shitting me? Like, yes, definitely. Of course. I know who that is. Like he thought it would be some, like, somebody that I hadn't heard of. So, yeah, then you came down, and that was that.
I learned, like, seven songs.
How was that process? I mean, that's a lot.
It was really cool. It was weird, because my career has been basically playing in Trans Am and another couple of friends' bands. Like, I've never, like, I hesitate using the word audition, but I kind of did, right?
Yeah, sure.
And learning somebody else's drum parts was, you know, learning Alan's drum parts was definitely a challenge. It was a fun challenge, you know, and it was a cool process. I mean,
Yeah, I mean, I was, of course, a little bit, you know, anxious the first time I came down. I was like, oh, am I going to, is this going to work out, you know?
Sure.
But, I mean, stylistically, like, you guys are very similar, but your presentation is very different.
Yeah.
I've never actually seen Alan live in person. I've only seen videos.
Yeah, Alan was, like, more of a, he was, like, more, his hands were, you know, he's more like a, well, we used to call him Donkey Kong, because it was like he, if he was going to hit a drum, his arms would go above his head.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, it was really like big and bold. And I think the kind of funny irony is Alan was like a natural big rock drummer.
Yeah.
But he really wanted to play controlled, kind of tighter, more like danceable groove beats. Whereas Seb is more naturally inclined to so the grooves beats,
sure.
And yet there's a rock drummer in there. So it's sort of weird because Alan wanted to be what Seb is, you know, and then Seb had to kind of step in and do like this is sort of weird. Like he had to learn parts that our drummer wrote, trying to basically do what he does. It's sort of it makes it odder and maybe more difficult.
Yeah.
Maybe, and this question might be a little easier for you, since because you've been 3 years now. But I want to ask both of you, do you have in mind like a best show you've ever played and a worst? And what happened with either?
I mean, there's just certain towns that where I remember just the crowd being really fucking awesome. I mean, as far as like the quality of our playing, it's always within, you know, 10%. And we can sit
But that's a new thing. Like, when in former lineups, we used to have some very awful shows.
Okay.
And I think when you guys joined, everybody just got more serious about playing in America. But anyway.
So, yeah, I mean, and the thing is, like, I mean, this is just for musicians in general, right? Like, you'll play super tight, and the crowd will be, like, really bad, and you'll get backstage, and you'll be like, God, we sucked tonight, right? It's like, we have no idea.
Yeah.
And then we'll play kind of a sloppy set, and the crowd will be like, it'll be like stage diving, and this massive mosh pit, and we'll get backstage, and we're like, we're the fucking ruled.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, so it's like,
it's
hard for us to, you know, because we're like busy playing.
Yeah.
So we can't really, you know, our brain is occupied with playing, so we can't be objective, you know. But anyway, I mean, there's just like, you know, London and New York are always good for us, just because it's the number of people that come out, and they're so.
Spain and Portugal are always insane shows.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
In Spain, what they do, which is awesome, they chant the guitar solos as if they were like a soccer match, a soccer game.
What do you mean?
Like the notes? Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Wow. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah. It's very cool.
But it sort of makes sense because initially, like my approach to writing those guitar parts was, or a lot of the melodies would be melodies that I wanted to sing, but at the time I wasn't a very competent singer, so I just turned them into, I just turned this one into a guitar part.
Okay.
So there was what it equated to was, you know, a little bit more languid, you know, like sort of vocal guitar parts. There's a lot of space between the notes. You can sing them. It's not like arpeggios.
They're not like shredding.
Yeah, and they're not like dissonant. They're really musical and sort of like
they're melodies.
Yeah, they are melodies.
Okay.
You know, and so yeah, like for instance, like and this goes to the point that Seb was touching on earlier, like. I'm just going to say, like, the show we played in Lisbon last year, we were in a venue that, like, didn't really sound that great. You know, the room was pretty much concrete and metal. So the reflections were really bad. You know, our sound guy was like, this is going to be a tough one for me to mix. And we were just thinking, oh, God, it's going to sound bad and everybody's going to know. But the thing is, that was probably the venue in town, you know, and that's what they're used to.
Yeah.
And I don't think we played particularly well, but it was one of the most, like, uplifting audiences. So, you know, at that point, it doesn't matter. Right?
Yeah, they were just so pumped.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But then you can just as easily go to a very metropolitan city that gets 15 similar shows a night. And people have to choose, and then there's a, you know, there's sort of a malaise that sets on the crowd, and you can play as well as you want. If they're sleepy, then our energy gets sapped, and you know, all the correctness and articulation in the world's not going to save it.
Yeah.
I want to hear each of you guys. What was the first concert you attended growing up?
I mean, like...
As a fan.
Like a big show or like...
How about both?
I'll tell you, the first giant show I saw was... I was living in Argentina in high school. And I actually went to the stadium, River Plate Stadium, to see the Amnesty International tour.
Wow.
Which was... It was Sting, Peter Gabriel, Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
Like, and Argentine bands. And like,
it must have been a blast.
Like 120,000 people.
Holy cow.
It was intense. I mean, none of those artists are my favorite band, musicians at all. I mean, I did love The Police as a kid, but Sting is incredibly annoying. But whatever. It was mind-blowing. I was like 15 or something.
And just that amount of people.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's Latin America. People are freaking out and jumping up and down and singing. And I was like, it was intense. So yeah, so one last story. One of my favorite bands in high school in Argentina was this ska band called Los Fabulosos Cadillacs, the Fabulous Cadillacs.
Awesome.
Which they're huge. They became massive. And my friends and I was also around 15, went to see them play like this TV station that had like a summer concert series. So we went to this park to watch them play. And there was like this little like man-made like pond in front of the stage, right? And like,
idea.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, so it's all kind of like rough and tumble, like ska fan kids, kind of a little bit, you know, well, you know.
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah,
so
I know what I'm trying to get at.
Like, yeah. Not the nicest kids, right? But you know, but nice kids. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
troublemakers.
They want to. Kind of gang like.
Yeah. So we're all waiting for the band to start, and they're like, it's like, I don't know why it's getting delayed, more and more delayed. And eventually the kids get into the pool, wade into the pool, get on stage, get all the gear, and start throwing the band's gear into the water.
Oh my God.
Right? Yeah. At like 5 p.m. And then all the cops show up.
Oh.
And we're like all running through the streets being chased by the cops. And of course, I thought like that was like most fun thing ever. It's like super fun, but anyway.
That's a great story.
What about you, John? Concert?
The first concert that I saw that I wanted to see, meaning my parents didn't take me to, was Sonic Youth, Superchunk, Boredoms, on Browns Island in Richmond, Virginia. So there's like a little island in the middle of the James River, and they had set up like a, you know, a proper sort of like festival style grounds with a, you know, a main stage and an auxiliary stage. And it was, you know, it was a great, it was an incredible show to begin with, because I was a fan of all of those bands.
Yeah.
I'd never seen anybody play like that before, you know, with that kind of looseness and like kind of, you know, sort of musical magic before. And it was also one of those shows that's outdoors that gets a massive thunderstorm, and so I remember, you know, it was kind of like the Woodstock thing, like everybody all of a sudden is just completely covered in mud, and the temperature differential was such that there was so much steam coming off people's bodies, it was kind of chilly, and everybody's really warm, that this, you know, the steam of off of, I don't know, maybe 7,000-10,000 people there was so thick that you actually couldn't see the stage at a certain point.
Wow.
And I don't know. There was a couple of things that impressed me about that show. Like, one was the fact that both Lee Ronaldo and Thurston Moore had a quiver of guitars that was like 20 deep. and you know, that was my first introduction to being addicted to gear and having too much,
I guess to kind of play on that, who are you guys, like, whether they're coming up or bands you're listening to right now, who are you kind of impressed by or really into? And I want to hear a guilty pleasure you may have musically.
You say guilty pleasure?
My guilty
pleasure. Like a Miley Cyrus or...
There is, I mean, there's a guilty pleasure that a few of us in the band are, I mean...
I gotta hear it.
For me, it's the Eagles.
That's not a guilty pleasure.
I don't think it's that guilty. Yeah,
I don't think... Guilty.
But the thing is, I mean... Guilty. You'd be some people get really fucking pissed off
when you say that. We put on Steely Dan and the Eagles, and some people get pissed.
People get fucking pissed off, and they're like, we have friends who play in bands who I won't mention who are like,
yeah,
like, you like the Eagles? Like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Joe Walsh is that guy's awesome.
He's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm a late convert, though.
Okay. See, but that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And there was
a time on tour where everybody knew I hated the Eagles so much that, like, we were on tour with this band, Valiant Thor, and their singer would constantly sing Eagles songs during sound check to piss me off. Yeah.
I mean, I understand why people hate it. It's like the most fucking white bread thing possible, yeah. And you know, like, but whatever. You know, yeah. I think, you know. And what's your guilty pleasure?
I mean, I probably would have gone with that too. I've been doing this thing for a while now. It's very difficult, and it's not as satisfying as it is trying, which is whenever possible, and I can do this at home pretty easily, and I try to do it on the road, but I try to listen to a record every day that I've never heard.
Oh, wow.
Which means I have to basically go to, like, pop charts.
Yeah.
And give them a spin. And if I do it, I'll commit to the entire breadth of the record. And it's,
I mean, how many,
it is rough.
What's your batting average as far as, like, actually?
That's a good question.
Oh, no, I make it through. I do.
Oh,
my batting average is,
dude,
my batting average is 1,000 there. My disgust factor is very high.
Honestly, the internet has made me very, my attention span is very short now. Like, yeah. I'll be like, somebody will mention a band, I'll get on YouTube or whatever, or Spotify, and I'll be like, after 30 seconds, I'm like, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Like,
yeah.
Which maybe is bad, I don't know.
No, I mean, but this is, my thought is, and this is just a little, like, my personality kind of suits this, but I just don't want to, it's very difficult for me to hear two people talking about music that I don't know.
Sure.
I get really bent out of shape about
it.
No, I want to know what's going on. Like, I also think that there is a huge contingency of active professional musicians that just stop listening.
Totally.
And which is fine.
Yeah.
I just don't understand that. You know, I think, you know, especially playing the style of music that we do, it behooves us to understand where we fit culturally, because on paper what we do is dead. The format of, you know, a four-piece rock and roll band is, like, has in theory been exhausted.
It's super conservative.
A long time ago, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if we're going to add something, then, you know, I've got a couple of different theories on how we can be relevant now in 2016. Without falling into the trappings of retroisms or desperate ploys for commercial success. One of which is listen to diverse music and pull the influences from stuff that doesn't seem like it would fit. And that's normally where I think some of my best ideas come from, are, you know, genres, music, and albums that have nothing whatsoever to do with what we do. You know, and that could be a mindset, it could be a musical contrivance, it could be, you know, a way of producing or arranging something.
A drum sound.
Yeah, whatever. Drum sound. It doesn't matter. But if I only listen to our genre of music, even the broader genre, you know, like heavy rock or something, I'm going to get bored really quickly. Because there's the herd is very flush with similarities. I don't want to be similar.
Sure.
I don't want this band to be unrecognizable in a group of 10, in a playlist of 10 different bands. I want our sound to be significant and current and interesting, without negating what we've done. You know, we have a history, we have certain things that are, you know, I think we've essentially claimed ownership on, you know, which are just musical devices, which, you know, is one thing. So as long as there's something recognizable there, anything and everything can be assimilated into our sound.
Okay,
that's cool.
And one more thing, when it doesn't work, we know. And we just don't do that. I mean, it's like, oh, that's not going to ever work with us. So, fine.
What about somebody you guys are into, like, these days? Maybe an up-and-comer kind of, that's still below the surface a little bit, that you guys are really high on?
I'm really into this new Philly band that is, like, intentionally not going to ever get big, but they're called Sheer Mag.
Okay.
They've released 2 7-inches, and that's it.
Wow.
And it kind of sounds like Thin Lizzy meets punk rock meets the Jackson 5, early Jackson 5.
So you don't think they're going to get big?
Oh, I think they could be huge. I don't think they want to get big. I think they intentionally don't make their music easily available. And
that's kind of cool.
it is cool. I mean, the way they play, and like what they are, that's the cool thing about them. They're going to stop themselves from ever getting recognizable.
What about you, Sebastian?
Like super new stuff? I don't know if I can think of anything offhand, like up and coming bands.
Or what would I find in your record player that's not the Eagles?
Oh, I mean, I mean, the last couple of years, like, you know how people do this thing for 5 years, you get into one thing. I've just been, this is why I always say, I've been listening to a lot of, like, basically, like, house music and techno the last 5 years. Yeah. And because I was interested in that, but never, like, sat down and got serious about it. And that's kind of what I... That's what I go see live, and live, you know. I'm doing air quotes right now, I mean that's kind of, and there is a lot of new music in that world. However, a lot of it is very sort of trying to sound like it's just from another era, which happens in rock music too, obviously. Yeah. But that's what I was like. Okay, Paranoid London, yeah. Friends of mine from London. That are called Paranoid London, and they're not paranoid at all, but they're
from London.
They're super cool.
Yeah,
very cool.
Sorry to interrupt.
No,
they actually did the same thing about that Sheer Mag did. Their stuff was impossible to find.
Yeah,
for a long time.
That's cool.
And also intentional.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, remember when I don't know if anybody remembers this, but like when Guided by Voices first came out. He was pressing enough 7 inches of those early songs to just give to his friends and family.
Oh, cool.
And he didn't really want them any further than that. He was just writing music for music. I mean, eventually it caught on, and he was sort of undeniable that he was a great, you know, the Guided by Voices were great songwriters, and they got record deals, and you know, everything happened. But there was a time where they just didn't want, you know, the point wasn't to get out there everywhere. So, you know, there's all different sorts out there, but... One thing I found to be, you know, really awesome this year, or in the past couple of years since I moved to Philadelphia, is I literally try to see 4 or 5 shows a week. And if it's like giant stadium stuff, if it's house music, if it's, you know, indie rock, singer-songwriter, I don't really care. I just, like, I want to go see things that I know are going to be bad because I'm going to try to find something in their production or their presentation that I like. I want to go see things that I think are going to be great and try to pick it apart and see what they're doing wrong. Or just, you know, I really enjoy the experience of live music and seeing what people are doing to enrich the experience.
That's cool. It's a really good mindset. I won't keep you guys all day. I got a few more for you. When you come to Chicago, is there anything you have to go do, whether it be food or a shop or whatever, anything like that?
It feels like we never have any time.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, my John's busy during the day, you know, doing maybe the events and stuff and other, you know, band-related things. And during the day, honestly, I'm just conserving my energy for the night. You know, I'm just, like, taking multiple naps.
The set list we're playing right now is pretty demanding. It's physically demanding, so it's like... If you don't have energy, it may show. But you know, if there's time, we'll go to museums. We'll go do whatever the local tourist thing is. But it's not. I mean, especially in Chicago and New York and LA and stuff, you never have time to do that because that's where all the journalists are. That's where all the your management, your people, your friends from wherever you grew up or wherever you went to school all gravitate to those big areas.
And just one more. What's next for Baroness? I know you guys got all this. I'm sure you countless dates coming up for the tour. You got all this music out. The new album, Purple, well, relatively new at this point. What's next for Baroness?
Near future, a few more weeks of tour, then some festivals in September and October.
Yeah. Then we go to Australia in December. I think we've still got. I think 2017 still got a little bit of life with this record, but I think we're also we're ready to start getting into next thing.
Well, guys, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Nice meeting you.
Can't get enough of Sound Sessions? Like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter @SoundSeshPod, and check us out on Instagram @SoundSessionsWGN.